Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Our election coverage continues with the candidates for the 7th Congressional District seat, incumbent Republican Tom Tiffany.
Rising prices is the biggest issue before the American people because we're hearing it at doors. We've knocked on 25,000 doors since the 1st of June here in the 7th Congressional District and asking people what their concerns are. It is their number one concern.
And his Democratic challenger, Dick Elsman.
He's not representing the best interests of the folks of this district. He voted against lowering the cost of insulin. He voted against the infant formula appropriations bill. He's voted against expanding rural broadband access.
We'll hear the views of both candidates after this. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We are deep into election season, and among the most important races on the November ballot are those for the U.S. Congress. Democrats currently hold a majority in the House of Representatives by only 9 seats, making every race crucial to determine which party will control the House. That includes our own 7th Congressional District covering Northwest Wisconsin. For many years, a Democratic stronghold, the district has been in Republican hands since 2009. It's now represented by Tom Tiffany of Hazelhurst, who faces Democrat Dick Elsman of Lac des Flambeaux in the November 8th election. Both candidates spoke with my WPR colleague, Rick Ryer. So without further ado, here are their conversations, beginning with Tom Tiffany.
I'm Rick Ryer. With us now is Tom Tiffany, our congressman from the 7th Congressional District. He's from Hazelhurst and is running as the incumbent Republican for the 7th Congressional District. Prior to being elected in May of 2020, during a special election for the seat, Congressman Tiffany served in the Wisconsin State Assembly and State Senate for the 12th District. He holds a degree in agricultural economics. Tom, thank you for joining us today.
It's good to join you here today, Rick.
I'm going to ask you the same question as we start, as we did in the primary. Tell us some about yourself and why you're seeking re-election.
Yeah, so I appreciate the introduction. The thing that I would add before I entered elected office in the state legislature in 2010, for 20 years, my wife Chris and I owned Wilderness Cruises up on the Willow Flowage, and I was also the dam tender up there, as we fondly called me, the dam man, up on the Willow Flowage. And we did that for 20 years. Terrific business, being able to serve people. And I grew up on a dairy farm, western Wisconsin, a little town, Elmwood, Wisconsin. Still have brothers and sisters that are in the farming business. Got my degree at UW-River Falls and then spent 7.5 years in southern Minnesota putting that degree to work, and then moved up to the Minocqua area in 1988 and been there since. No better place to be than the Northwoods. My wife, Chris, and I have 3 daughters, and we are a little bit, it's bittersweet this year. The last one just went off to college, so we're now empty nesters.
Tom, the economy continues to be the top concern among voters nationwide, and that's according to many polls. The president signed the Inflation Reduction Act recently amid a lot of fanfare. Nevertheless, the measure passed on strict party-line vote, and the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says it will actually not have a big impact on inflation in the next couple of years. What can Congress do to address rising inflation and fears of recession?
So first of all, you are correct that inflation, rising prices, is the biggest issue before the American people because we're hearing it at doors. We've knocked on 25,000 doors since the 1st of June here in the 7th Congressional District and asking people what their concerns are. It is their number one concern. And the way we can do it is how we can reverse course is to stop the excessive government spending. This is what got us in this trouble. President Clinton and President Obama's economic advisor, Larry Summers, told President Biden back in February of 2021, do not try to get this bill passed, the first $2 trillion that was spent. There's been trillions since. But he said it's going to have an inflationary impact. And boy, was he correct. And so people know what the problem is. It's a matter of providing a solution, and that's what I'm talking about. Stop the excessive government spending. Let's go back to energy independence, bringing energy prices down, because that ripples through all of society and is inflationary. And let's get people back to work. We have a lot of people sitting on the sidelines at this point that are able to have government transfer or welfare payments, and they've chosen not to work. We do those three things. We fix those three things, and we will begin to get a hold of inflation.
Another thing that President Biden recently did, he announced a plan to eliminate up to $20,000 in student loan debt for borrowers who received Pell grants and up to $10,000 for borrowers who did not receive Pell funding. Economists disagree on the long-term effect on inflation. How do you think student loan forgiveness will affect the economy overall in the long term?
Yeah, it's going to have an inflationary impact. Once again, there's going to be this loan forgiveness. It's not paid for, so therefore it's borrowed or printed money, and it's going to have an inflationary impact. It's very unfortunate. It's unfortunate you're seeing these election year politics. President Biden knows he's in real trouble at this point, and his party's in trouble because of these policies they've been implementing over the last year and a half, and they're really trying to energize their base. They view part of their base as these recent college graduates who are in their 20s, and they want to find ways to encourage them to vote. And I just think it's a very cynical way of going about it, and it is the rest of American taxpayers that have to pay for it. This is one of the most talked about proposals that President Biden has put in place. We have received so many calls on this. And I have to say, between this and the 87,000 more IRS agents that was authorized in the Inflation Reduction Act, people are really upset with these two proposals. They know this takes America in the wrong direction.
Turning to crime, crime rates across the U.S. are going up. At the same time, some major cities and some in Congress have been calling to defund the police. Others are looking into bail reform measures. You introduced the Prosecutors Need to Prosecute Act. How would this address crime rates across the country?
So when you look at, I believe there's two big reasons why we've seen this explosion in crime across America. And by the way, it's bleeding out of the big cities now, coming to our local communities also. All you have to do is talk to the local sheriffs and they'll tell you about it. One is police are in retreat. Because you have politicians, especially in the big cities, these, I hate to say it, but Democrat-run cities that are refusing to support their police. So the police are in retreat and they're not dealing with the crime that's there. Take a look at Minneapolis. They don't have nearly enough cops. And people that want to be policemen, they're sure as heck not applying in Minneapolis. And so you have that problem with not backing the badge. But also you have prosecutors not doing their jobs. We saw a prosecutor out in San Francisco recently recalled as a result of not prosecuting crime. And we've seen it in Wisconsin also. So what our bill does is it puts responsibility on these prosecutors to provide reports to the federal government saying, are you prosecuting violent crime? Because we're seeing it not happen at this point. There needs to be some accountability by these, call them woke prosecutors, that think that that they don't have to prosecute crime, that they would rather coddle criminals rather than get justice for victims of crime.
Kind of reversing that a little bit, Tom, the U.S. has the highest incarceration rate in the world, with an incarceration rate that increased more than 500% since the 1970s. How should we as a society evaluate whether incarceration is the most appropriate in sentencing offenders, depending on the level of their crime?
Well, I think if you look back a couple years ago in the previous administration, they actually took some action to de-incarcerate, if that's a word, Rick, people. And I think there's been some success with that. I mean, perhaps that can be a model. But I have to tell you that if people commit a crime, especially a violent crime, they need to do the time for it. And I think that's what we need to be focused on at this point, because we're seeing far too many Americans turning into victims at this point of crime. We should be focused on making sure that people are accountable for the crimes that they're committing.
And how can we keep our communities and our schools safe in the wake of recent deadly shootings?
Yeah, you really have this lawlessness that's going on across America, and it starts by having respect for police, respect for law enforcement. We need to do what's right for them, and they need to be accountable also, and that can be done while also respecting the role of police providing public safety in our communities. And then the prosecutors, they need to do their jobs. They need to make sure that people are charged. I mean, take a look at the Waukesha Christmas Parade disaster last year, where six people were run over by a guy that was let out on low bail by District Attorney John Chisholm in Milwaukee County, who has a long history. He said that I'm going to institute this system, which is light on, that's basically going to be light on crime. And he said, will some people die as a result? Absolutely. That was his quote in 2007. Well, some people did die, and we really need to reverse course with these soft on crime prosecutors. And by the way, this engenders crime when you allow more crime to happen. If you send the message that we're not going to find this acceptable in our communities, which in many places, Minneapolis, Milwaukee being two of them, Chicago, it is acceptable at this point to conduct a life of crime. That causes more people to get involved. That's why you have to have tough law enforcement and good prosecutors.
Wisconsin's 172-year-old abortion ban was reinstated after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. According to a recent Gallup poll, 13% of people oppose abortion in all circumstances, while 35% support abortion under all circumstances, and 50% support abortion under some circumstances. Should the federal government play a role in determining the legality of abortion, and if so, how?
I think it should be returned to the states, and I've been pretty consistent with that. If you take a look, first of all, I am pro-life. I believe that's a life in the mother's womb. And but if you take a look at what my Democrat colleagues, how they voted in the House of Representatives this year, every one of them voted for abortion on demand, including third trimester abortions and partial birth abortion. That's barbaric. I think there's a much better place that we can be. For example, a few years ago when I was in the state legislature, we voted on a 20-week ban. We called it the pain-capable legislation because the baby or fetus can feel pain at that point, and we should not allow abortions after that. I think that's an example of the approach some states are going to take at this point is to they're going to decide what's best for them. And I would really encourage people on this issue, don't take someone on the right or the left, Republican, Democrat, whatever, don't take their word for it. Go read Justice Alito's decision, because he made it very clear for overturning Roe versus Wade, we need to return this decision to the people. They took it away from the people in 1973. Let's have democracy work is basically what Justice Alito was saying. I really encourage people to read that decision. And I believe we can both respect life of the child as well as respecting the life of the mother.
Some LGBTQ advocates worry that same-sex marriage rights might be in jeopardy because of that decision. Should the government, federal government, take action to protect the legality of same-sex marriages?
I would encourage people once again to read Justice Alito's decision from the Dobbs case, because he made it very clear that we are just deciding the issue in regards to abortion. We are not deciding the issue of same-sex marriage or anything like that. What I'm hearing from some people who have were long advocates for same-sex marriage or perhaps are in same-sex marriages, they're becoming very concerned about what the Biden administration is doing at this point in trying to do things like undermine Title IX. I mean, there's rulemaking that is going on right now which would punish schools if they don't allow boys, biological boys, to play girls' sports, to be able to go into girls' bathrooms. To me, that makes no sense at all. And some people that were longtime advocates of same-sex marriage are very concerned about the direction the Biden administration is going with something as extreme as saying boys should be able to play girls' sports. As a father of three daughters who played interscholastic sports, and this being the 50th anniversary of Title IX, what a great leveling of the field for girls and women to be able to participate on an equal basis. It would be terribly unfortunate to undermine Title IX as the Biden administration is proposing to do.
On that issue of education, how can the federal government support sound education policies at the local level?
Yeah, the best way the federal government can support local schools is to get out of their business. And exactly as I'm citing with this Title IX case, they're going to come in and tell schools how they need to carry out their educational program. They continue to dump more and more requirements on school. I was just meeting with a group of school administrators, and one said, stop the COVID stuff, stop all these other mandates and requirements on us because you're not allowing us to teach kids at this point. The federal government needs to butt out of our schools and allow them to be a state and local function. And we saw it with COVID. You had Dr. Fauci saying that, boy, we have to put in these draconian measures, closing down schools, things like that, sending out guidance that said kids should wear masks, kids shouldn't be in school, and look at the harm that it's done. I mean, there's just news stories out here recently talking about how educational attainment has declined in America for the first time, for example, on math scores. And that's in large part because of the federal government inserting itself into our local schools. They need to get out of telling our local schools how to operate.
Many Wisconsin farms and factories depend on migrant workers. And of the unauthorized migrant workers in the state, about two-thirds of them have been here for more than 10 years. At the same time, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has been sending buses of migrants out of his state to sanctuary cities, recently in Chicago, as a way to draw attention to the issue of illegal immigration in his state. Both sides of the aisle agree that changes to the immigration system need to be made. Yet, there's little talk. It's from our perspective, there doesn't seem to be a solution coming forward at this point in time. What changes would you make to the current immigration system?
Yeah, so both sides are talking about the border issue, but they're talking about it in very different ways. How we talk about it as Republicans is securing the border and then doing what is right for America. Let's have an America first immigration policy, because we should have immigration. But it should be legal immigration. You have all these people coming in illegally, and it's up to 5 million people now that have come into our country illegally. They jumped ahead of the line. That is wrong. But they're also, the Biden administration has turned our United States government into the biggest human trafficking operation perhaps in the history of the world. When you see it as I have with my 5 trips to the border, my trip to Panama, you see how this trafficking operation works. We saw 51 people fried to death near San Antonio in the back of a semi-trailer that were being trafficked into America. And then you see the fentanyl that has doubled in, perhaps even exceeded that, but certainly the volume has at least doubled that's coming into America. And for the first time, we saw over 100,000 overdose deaths in America last year. Why is that? Because of that fentanyl that's coming in, that's killing, is the number one killer now of people 18 to 45 years of age, and it's happening right here. What's coming in our front door down in the southern states ends up in our backyard here, and it's killing people. We have to secure the border and then put together a reasonable immigration system that benefits America. And some of that will be to provide labor for our factories and things like that. But it should be on a basis of us knowing who is in our country. Because with that 5 million people, there's hundreds of thousands of gotaways. We don't know who they are. Do they have terrorist backgrounds? We know that there's people with terror ties that have come into our country. So you have a national security problem. You also have the problem of getting public benefits on the taxpayer's dime as a result of this. It is not working for America at this point. And Democrats are not providing a solution at this point. They want the issue, but they do not want to make the changes necessary. I sit on the Judiciary Committee. We've put forward many proposals to get the border under control. All of our bills are not receiving a hearing.
That was incumbent Republican Congressman Tom Tiffany of Wisconsin's 7th District. Up next is Democratic challenger Dick Osmond. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We continue with our interviews of the candidates for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District, representing the northwest portion of the state, this time with Democrat Dick Alsman. Here's his conversation with my WPR colleague, Rick Ryer.
I'm Rick Ryer. With us now is Dick Alsman. Dick Alsman was born and raised in Merrill. He is running as a Democrat for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. He graduated from the University of Wisconsin and is a business media publisher. Dick Alsman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Rick, I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're running for this office?
I live in Lac des Flambeaux, had a year-round home for 25 years there, but was born and raised, as you mentioned, in Merrill. My parents both grew up on farms, and when I was 7, my dad passed away. My mom had 6 kids, 4 were at home. There was no insurance, no savings. She worked at a department store. She started selling Avon products. We got food in white boxes from the county home. She baked bread. I delivered it around the neighborhood. She rented out my sister's bedroom to a student at the teacher's college to make ends meet. She really defined who I am. After graduating from Merrill Senior High, I went to the University of Wisconsin and was a member of the marching band. And that was one of the funnest moments of my life. I'm the only person in the world that folks will meet that's done a complete somersault strapped to a bass drum. While at the university, I started working at the local weekly newspaper, and it was struggling, but I was paid to do circulation. When I left that paper 8 years later, it was the 20th largest daily newspaper in the state of Wisconsin by circulation. I then went to Milwaukee, created an alternative weekly newspaper. Within 3 years, won the Milwaukee Press Club Award for best feature writing in the state of Wisconsin. We beat every newspaper in the state. And then I went into business publishing. I became a leading executive in one of the largest publishing companies in the world. And my publication there won 2 Jesse H. Neal Awards, which are considered the Pulitzer Prize of the business press. It's all about the quality of the content. And then I was about to start a new publishing company after the pandemic, one of my own, when I realized that Tom Tiffany was going to run unopposed. And that's why I'm with you here today.
If you were elected, what would your top 2 priorities be?
Top 2 priorities are health care. I've put on 17,000 miles on my truck since starting this out in May. I've been all over this district. It's half the state, 26 counties. And whether you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, health care is a major concern. 58% of all American debt is medical debt, and people worry about it. And so I think we can have a system, whether it's Medicaid for all, which was the interesting part is people think of it as a Democratic idea, but it was actually introduced by Richard Nixon. But we could have a system where everybody gets quality health care. If we're treating people up front, if they're getting annual physicals, when they're feeling sick, they go in and see someone, we prevent the expensive part of treating the diseases and the cancer down the road. So I believe health care is a priority just based on the folks I've talked with, as well as Social Security. A lot of people are concerned about Social Security, and the reality is it can be solved in one day. Most folks aren't aware that there's a cap. Currently, when someone makes $147,000 a year, they stop contributing to Social Security. Eliminate the cap, and Social Security is immediately solved.
The economy continues to be a top concern among voters nationwide, according to multiple polls. And just recently, the Inflation Reduction Act was signed by President Biden. Amid quite a bit of fanfare, nevertheless, the measure passed on a strict party-line vote, and the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says it will actually not have a big impact on inflation in the next couple of years. What can Congress do to address rising inflation and fears of recession?
Well, I mean, we've been through 3 huge whammies in the last couple of years. The pandemic, we haven't experienced something like this for 100 years. And, obviously the economy shut down and we're coming back from that. And that with that came super shock number 2 of, a lot of baby boomers decided not to return to the marketplace, or people who worked for companies decided to branch out on their own. And so now we have this, a shortage of workers. And then you add in number 3 of Ukraine, of the Russia invading the sovereign nation of Ukraine, that shocked the world oil prices. And I mean, they've come down quite a bit, $1.50 since I filled the truck tank this morning. But, you know, these things will work their way out, but everything is made from oil. And when you have a shock in the oil industry, unless something is a natural fiber like cotton or something like that, there's basically petroleum in it. What excites me is my daughter's a chemical engineer, and they're working out how to make things from plants instead of fossil fuels. So that'll be huge in the future. You know, with the Inflation Reduction Act, it was interesting because I listened to the broadcast with Tom Tiffany, and he talks about the importance of bringing down the deficit. In fact, I think he said it was the most important thing. And the CBO predicts that the Inflation Reduction Act will reduce the deficit by $100 billion, yet he voted against it. So, you know, we're America. We'll come back. We've been dealing with some very the thousand-year flood as to our economy, but we'll come back. Things are, you know, gas prices are going down. We're figuring we need to transition to green energy, and, you know, that'll help, and that's a big part of the Inflation Reduction Act as well. And the encouraging part to me is, like, where places that were dependent upon producing fossil fuels or coal, there's extra credits. So if the companies go and invest there, you know, they're going to, you know, there's an incentive for them to actually invest in the places that are losing jobs because they're not producing the coal and the fossil fuels. So I think it'll make a significant impact.
Now, in addition to the Inflation Reduction Act, President Biden announced a plan to eliminate up to $20,000 in student loan debt for borrowers who receive Pell Grants as well, and up to $10,000 for borrowers that qualify that did not receive Pell funding. Economists disagree on the long-term effect on inflation. How do you think student loan forgiveness will affect the economy over the long term?
Well, there's going to be more disposable income. You know, instead of paying debt, people are probably going to invest in buying things. And so from that perspective, it'll be good for the economy. You know, it saddens me. When I went to school, you know, tuition was like $469 a semester. I could actually work and pay my bills. I have two daughters in college. There's no way on God's green earth they could pay their way through college. And folks have debt of like 6-7%. It's stunning, more than what people pay for a home mortgage. So there's something actually broken there. And one of the things I think as well is, you know, maybe those who hold the loan should have eaten a little bit in this as well, making 7% off of our future, because our future is based, education is an investment in our society. We want a well-educated populace. It'll just make things better in the future. And the things that we can do to help them, I mean, I believe community college and tech school should be free. You know, let's get the plumbers and the electricians, folks who can have really well-paying jobs, let's move them after high school into positions where they can create a good living for themselves. And so, you know, the inflation, you know, by reducing that money, I'm assuming it's just going to be put back into the economy in another way, which will feed the economy instead of paying off the debt.
Well, that would beg the question, how is that going to be paid for?
I don't have the answer for that. I'm not sure. I haven't read all the specifics of it. I don't know if there's any offsets to it or anything like that. I don't know.
Crime rates across the country have been going up. At the same time, there are some major cities and some in Congress that have been calling to defund the police. Others are looking into bail reform measures. If elected, how would you address crime in America?
When I was 11, my mom remarried. My stepdad sold almost all of the police and firefighting equipment in northern Wisconsin, from Stevens Point north to Hurley, west as far as Hawkins. Our best friends were the police chiefs, the fire chiefs, the sheriffs. State patrol officer was a good friend, covered Minocqua. And I remember hearing him one time talking with my parents. I was probably 12, 13. And he was talking about every time he went to a car, he worried about someone assaulting him or shooting him. And he actually retired from the force and picked up another job. I'm not here to defund the Blue. I'm here to back the Blue. You know, they were our best friends. They are, you know, they're here to keep us secure. I'm sorry, I may have strayed from your question.
How would you, if elected, address crime in America?
Well, I mean, nobody wants crime. Again, when I listen to Tom Tiffany on your show, he's like, you know, it's like the prosecutors don't prosecute violent crime. I can't imagine any prosecutor not wanting to prosecute someone who's committed a violent crime against someone. He basically was saying that the police forces, our law enforcement folks, aren't doing their job. You know, part of what we've been through with all of this upheaval in our economy is, you know, it's hard getting law enforcement officers. You know, again, every time they walk up to a car, someone could assault them. I think, you know, some of these jobs start out at in the mid 40,000s. I think they should be paid a lot more for the danger that they put themselves in. So, I mean, we need to have more law enforcement officers. We need to pay them well. We also need to make sure that they're equipped to handle the threats that are against them. You know, I don't, nobody wants crime. It's just, you know, helping people do their job. I don't think it's Tom Tiffany's thing of having every DA file of how they're handling every case. I'm not really sure what that's going to do for our future. You know, it's getting out there and enforcing the laws. You know, you look at the insurrection of January 6th, you know, the violence that occurred there, people are being prosecuted for it. But I mean, it was the largest display of mass violence I've seen probably in my lifetime, and yet a lot of people deny it. And law enforcement died. A lot of people were injured. Law enforcement folks were injured there. So, you know, you have the Republican Party saying crime is at a low, but when they're backing one of the greatest mass insurrections that have occurred.
Let me flip the question around a little bit here. The U.S. has the highest incarceration rate in the world, with a rate that has increased more than 500% since 1970. How should we as a society evaluate whether incarceration is the most appropriate sentence for some offenders?
Well, my guess is you're going to find most of those offenders, from what I've read, are in there for drug offenses. And, you know, Wisconsin is one of the few states, we're an island, every state around us has legalized, either for recreational or medicinal use, cannabis. And, you know, with that, a lot of these states are expunging the records of folks. And my guess is you have an awful lot of people sitting in jail that are based on drug offenses and nonviolent drug offenses. And my guess is if you cleared a lot of that out, you'd probably reduce a lot of the folks in the jail systems.
Wisconsin's 172-year-old abortion ban was reinstated after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, according to a recent Gallup poll. 13% of people oppose abortion in all circumstances, while 35% support abortion under all circumstances, and 50% support abortion under some circumstances. Should the federal government play a role in determining the legality of abortion? And if so, what role?
Yes. We were formed as a secular country. Our founding fathers, and I will say mothers, because I'm sure the husbands were talking to their wives when we were creating our Constitution, you know, they're very faith-based, but yet they were very insistent that we were to be set up as a secular country. You know, we all have the ability to worship when, where, and how we choose, but we don't have the ability to impose our religious views on others. And that's what's happening here. You have religion creeping into the state, and it has to be reversed. You know, half of the world doesn't believe that that life begins until after birth. So, you know, again, it's a religious discussion. So it's a woman's body, it's a woman's choice, just as it's a man's body and it's a man's choice.
Some LGBTQ advocates worry that same-sex marriage rights might be in jeopardy in the wake of Roe v. Wade. Should the federal government take action to protect the legality of same-sex marriage?
Yes. We're here to protect all citizens. I'm not here to say whether someone should be heterosexual, gay, lesbian, transgender. We are who we are. Love is love. And, you know, that is what the majority of Americans agree with from the polls they've seen, just like the majority of Americans believe there should be choice for the woman. That's not what the government should be sticking their nose into. We're here to make sure that all citizens are treated equal. And, you know, by color, by anything else that you want to define or describe a person. It doesn't matter. We're all humans, and we all deserve the same respect and rights. So if it takes the federal government to get involved to ensure that, absolutely.
On the issue of education, how can the federal government support sound education policies at the local level?
At the local level, you know, I think one of the problems is that you have a lot of, I'm not a big fan of the voucher system. You know, you're taking money out of the public school systems. I lived in Milwaukee for 3 years, and the fascinating fact back then is most teachers didn't send their kids to the public schools. That's a pretty bad indicator. You know, I grew up in the public school system. My kids grew up in the public school system. We could have afforded to have them in the best private school, and my wife and I are very insistent. We wanted them in the public school. We wanted them meeting folks of every different type of culture and background. So, you know, taking away money from the public schools to inject into private schools I don't like it. I don't agree with it. Again, from an education perspective, we need to make it affordable. 7% interest rates is not affordable. I believe, again, community college, tech schools should be free. I don't know the exact percentage, but I think, you know, loans for colleges and such should be administered by the government, and we could do it for probably 1% and cover our administrative costs. We don't need to be making money on educating our workforce, or we don't need to have private industry inflating the costs to prevent folks from gaining an education. An educated workforce will make for a better world. We want everybody to have access to education. And it starts at the local level, and most folks are in public schools. And again, we don't want to be draining money from the public schools, and we need to support our teachers. Under the Walker administration, their collective bargaining rights were decimated. And we need to look back as how do we support our teachers. I mean, you look when you're filing your taxes, these folks even have a credit for because they have to spend their own funds to buy school supplies and things like that. I don't think the teachers should have to be supplying the tools that their students need in their classes. We should be able to be providing that in our communities.
And how do we keep our schools and communities safe in the wake of recent shootings?
Well, I mean, you're getting into gun safety. And, you know, we need to make sure our schools are protected when doors aren't locked, if there's not bulletproof glass and things like that. It has to be there. We need to make sure that our schools are properly set and tooled to protect our kids. Outside of that is you have the gun violence. And, you know, with the 17,000 miles I put on my truck, the last month and a half has been mostly fairs and farm events, and I'm mostly talking to Republicans. And I own firearms. I'm not here to take anyone's firearms away. But there's four things that I have found that all the Republicans agree with me on, literally at least 95 to 98%. You don't need more than 5 or 6 bullets in a clip. I've hunted. I've never taken more than 2 or 3 shots at a deer. You know, you just don't need that. And if in a mass shooting situation, you know, it gives people the ability to fight back. People are buying these things a day or two before. And if anyone's used a clip in a rifle, even if you've done it a lot, you sometimes have a problem getting it in there. There's buttons to press. You got to get in straight. It gives people a chance to fight back, run away. We need to have a database that no matter where you buy a gun, no matter who sells it, you know, we need to check to ensure that the person who's purchasing it is entitled to purchase a firearm. Red flag laws, which Tom Tiffany railed against, you know, you have Republican states that have it. Someone who's been legally deemed a danger to themselves or others, you need to remove their weapon. When they're legally deemed no longer a danger to themselves or others, they can have it back. And something that was brought to me by a Republican at Farm Tech Days in Loyal was, you know, I had to take a hunter safety course before I could have a rifle and hunt. And I didn't realize you don't have to do that anymore. I mean, anyone who is going to purchase a firearm for the first time needs to take a gun safety course to not know that you don't leave a bullet in the chamber, that there's a thing called a safety on it, that you walk with the muzzle pointed down. There's just basic safety things that people need to know. And at that time, also, they can be evaluated to whether or not you know, they should have that weapon by the instructor. Those four things, again, I'm not exaggerating, 95 to 98% of every Republican that I've talked to agrees with that. So if we have the Democrats and Republicans all agreeing on this stuff, why can't we get this legislation into action? You know, we've had a little movement a few months ago, but we need bigger movement. And it just doesn't seem the will to be there, but the public wants it, and it's time to get it done.
Do you see these measures that they can be accomplished while balancing Second Amendment rights?
Yeah, I'm not here to take away anyone's guns. Again, I own guns. You know, I disagree with the Democratic Party in that I don't believe in an assault on ban on assault rifles. I have a British 303 Army officer's rifle that's more powerful than an AK-47. But again, you don't need more than 3-4 bullets in it. You know, that's the difference. And anything that can convert it into an automatic weapon, absolutely not. You know, there's things we need to do to ensure that these weapons are used as they were intended for.
Turning to immigration, many Wisconsin farms and factories depend on migrant workers. And of the unauthorized migrant workers in the state, about 2/3 of them had been here for more than 10 years. At the same time, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has been sending buses of migrants out of his state to sanctuary cities, recently Chicago, as a way to draw attention to the issue of illegal immigration in his state. Both sides of the aisle agree that changes need to be made to the system, but there's little agreement on exactly how to do that. What changes would you make or consider to the current immigration system?
It was interesting because, again, I listened to your program just to see how it went. And I heard Tom Tiffany talking about the three things that you could change immediately. And one of them didn't even exist. Tom Tiffany is pretty loose with the truth and facts. He said that, you know, the Return to Mexico program had been no longer existed. Well, President Biden did shut it down on his first day in office. But about 5-6 months later, the Supreme Court overturned him. And for the last year plus, and even it wasn't until after your interview with him when Biden said that he isn't going to stop doing the moving back to Mexico. So he's talking about a process that didn't even exist. Immigration is fundamental to our country. You know, up in Lac des Flambeaux, Minocqua area, we're reliant on immigrants, people coming in for the tourism jobs, agriculture, and you have businesses that aren't even open. The Burger King at one point was open from 4 to 11 because they didn't have anybody to staff it. There's restaurants downtown Minocqua that aren't open because they don't have staff. We need folks for jobs. And, you know, the immigration process, if you look at it, what I'd go back and look, because I wanted to see, well, what's it been over the last 20 years? And under the Obama administration was the lowest level of legal immigration in the past 20 years. And, you know, whatever was going on back then, we need to figure out what was happening because it was definitely working. You know, also what I looked at over the last 20 years is when you have a recession, all of a sudden you see the immigration pop up. And it, you know, makes sense. If things are bad here, they're probably worse somewhere else, and people are going to try and come to the land of opportunity. So, you know, and so I don't have what the answer is for it, but I mean, I come from immigrants. We all come from immigrants unless we're Native Americans or descendants of Native Americans. And thankfully, our parents, grandparents, whoever, were welcomed as immigrants. But, you know, also when Tom's talking about these, millions of people coming over the border, bringing with the fentanyl, we're catching these millions of people at the border. It's not like they're all coming in and bringing all this fentanyl and methamphetamine or whatever. You know, we're catching them. That's why we know the numbers. And again, if you look at the statistics, you can see when there's a recession or right after the pandemic, it spiked up. People were looking to improve their lives. And so we need to figure this out. But I would go back to the Obama years and look to see what were they doing then, because it was consistently the lowest levels of attempted illegal immigration into this country.
And that was Dick Alsman, the Democratic challenger in the race for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Coming up, the candidates' closing statements. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We conclude our candidate interviews for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District with closing statements by each. Here again is incumbent Republican Tom Tiffany, followed by his Democratic challenger, Dick Ausman. Both are speaking with WPR's Rick Ryer.
What separates you from your opponent, and what are your top two priorities going into the next session if you do get reelected?
Yeah, so my top priorities, and people will see it in my literature piece that I'm going to be passing out at the doors here, is you all know what the problems are. And in regards to inflation, it's real simple. Stop the excessive federal government spending. Stop that. Get America back to energy independence where we bring the cost of energy down, and we'll begin to rein in inflation. How do we become energy independent? We say to the producers in America, produce. Rather than doing like President Biden did and beg the Saudis to drill for more oil. The border, real simple, 2 years ago, we were getting control of our border. I saw it firsthand down in Arizona. Reinstitute remain in Mexico, stop catch and release, finish the wall, and maybe rather than having all those jobs go to IRS agents that were proposed in an Inflation Reduction Act, let's have some of them become Border Patrol agents. And on crime, respect the police, and prosecutors need to do their job. So it is not hard. I should say, it just requires the will to do it. This is not hard to do. It just requires the political will to do it. And I'm prepared to do that. And that's what sets me apart from my opponent, is I'm willing to make those tough decisions. No different than when I was in the state legislature 10 years ago and we had a $3 billion deficit. I worked night and day, including on the Finance Committee, to get America, or Wisconsin back in the red, our budget, get our budget back in the black. And we did it, and it served Wisconsin well. We can do the same thing at the federal level. It just requires the will to do it. I have it, and that's why I would ask people for their vote for reelection.
Tom Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was good to join you, Rick.
Dick Ausman, what separates you from your opponent, and what do you want voters to know about you when they head to the polls?
I'm here to help you. Tom Tiffany, he's not representing the best interests of the folks of this district. He's voted against lowering the cost of insulin. He voted against the infant formula appropriations bill. He's voted against expanding rural broadband access and rebuilding our roads and bridges. Yet he even in one interview in his last election said we have to expand broadband access, and he voted against it. He's voted against all aid for Ukraine. He wants to privatize Social Security, which is a horrible idea. And, you know, I just voted against our veterans, you know, the assistance for our veterans who have been exposed to all these toxic substances. He also voted against the Gold Star Education Act for helping the families of our veterans or of our folks who have died serving our country. He's not helping folks. You know, I grew up in the Republican Party. Our best friends of my family were Tiny Krieger, Sheehan Donahue, Alvin Yokonski, who represented a large part of this district. They'd all be called Democrats today. And when I'm talking to Republicans, I also help to understand them that my dad's first cousin was Laverne Osman. He was Secretary of the Agriculture, Republican, two-time Assemblyman, Republican. He was head of the Farm Bureau under the first Bush, Republican. And he just recently passed away in December, but we had a family reunion a few years ago. And I asked him, I said, you know, Laverne, what do you make of everything that's going on? And he goes, he was the tallest Osman in our family, probably 6'4", I bet. And he has always had a gentle smile. He looked down and he goes, all I can say is this is the first time in my life I didn't vote Republican for president. And I try and help people understand that this is not the Republican Party 45, 50 years ago. I was a proud Republican 45, 50 years ago. I am a very proud Democrat today. Tom Tiffany is, you know, he in his interview with you, talks about being from the party of Abe and how in, I think, 1854, the party was created to abolish slavery. Yet, I used to go to Ripon. My brother went to school there, and he used to play piano in the Republican Lounge, and it was like a shrine to me to see the little white schoolhouse where the Republican Party formed because they're so proud that this was the party that abolished slavery. Yet Tom Tiffany was one of 14 legislators that voted against the Juneteenth bill recognizing it as a federal holiday to recognize the end of slavery. Don't tell me you're from the party of Abe. Or, you know, Tom Tiffany is the rhino in the room. And, you know, I'm here to represent everybody, whether they're Republican, Democrat, Independent, Green, whatever it might be. I'm here to represent the people. We can make things happen. And one of the greatest things that I've found traveling around visiting with folks is what they're upset with is that the legislators aren't talking. It's one party against the other. One thing that's made me successful in business is that when I get people in a room, you know, we talk, we figure out an idea, and we get something done. And if it can't come from that, then as a leader, I make a decision. But, you know, we need to get back to talking, working together, reaching across the aisle. What I'm interested in is the ideas that will help the people of the 7th District and also every citizen in this United States, because the representative is also responsible for looking out for everybody's interests. And that's what I will do.
Dick Ausserman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Rick, thanks so much for having me. On Wisconsin.
And that concludes our candidate interviews for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.